No te quedes callada, no levantes la voz, ni me pidas perdón. Aunque casi te confieso que también he sido un perro compañero, un perro ideal que aprendió mal a ir y a volver al hogar para poder comer. Flaca, no me claves tus puñales por la espalda.
tu ex todo te recuerda. Recuerda.
11, 12, 13, 102. Tenemos la solución para el mal del corazón.
Hola. Llevo 4 semanas jodido pasando mal.
Hola, Sebastián. Aquí estoy para escucharte. Cuéntame, ¿qué sientes?
Tristeza. Se fue un lunes y el jueves la vieron con otro man.
Eso duele, cariño, pero deberías estar tranquilo. Tienes que rehacer tu vida.
He intentado que me... Parece que se fue, mi vida es un meme. Tengo una nube encima y todo el día llueve. Parece que tengo COVID porque nada me sabe, nada me huele. Y ahora es como le hago. Las series que empezamos juntos no las acabo. Ciudades y lugares que quedaron bloqueados. Por ella de un millón y ella por mí ni un centavo. Recordaré todo lo que hicimos, lo que un día nos prometimos. Las noches que nos comimos y soñamos. Y siento que estoy mejor.
Muy bien, muy bien. ¿Y qué sientes cuando piensas en ella?
Nostalgia. Todavía se siente un vacío en la habitación.
Es normal, pero tienes que dar el siguiente paso. ¿Por qué no?
Me intentaba que me... Ya saqué su foto de mi billetera. Dicen mis amigos que volvió la fiera. Me mudé de piso en otra ciudad. Vida nueva, el tiempo me ha demostrado que para ir al futuro hay que guardar el pasado. Pensando en nosotros me tenía olvidado. Por ella de un millón y ella por mí ni un centavo.
Recordaré todo lo que hicimos, lo que un día nos prometimos, las noches que nos comimos y soñar sin dormir. Olvidaré su locura, los celos y la amargura. No hay más que cien años dura y esto le llama a vivir.
Hola, quiero darte las gracias, no sé qué habría hecho sin ti.
Ay, pues eso me alegra mucho, Sebastián. Igualmente tú sígueme llamando, sígueme llamando.
Tranquila, abrí los que tienen final, no hay por qué olvidarlas. Recordaré todo lo que hicimos, lo que un día nos prometimos, las noches que nos comimos y soñar sin dormir. Olvidaré tu locura, los celos y la amargura. No hay mal que 100 años dura y esto le llaman vivir. Sí que supimos vivir. Sí que supimos vivir.
Sebastián, ¿estás ahí? Sebastián, escucha, ¿y esto cuando me lo pagas?
Tengo millas de vuelo para ir a Plutón. Tengo un club de fans en la luna. Una casa gigante que veo desde un avión. Y en los ojos de algunos fortuna. Un ejército de alcahuetes. Un conflicto con Bush. Una suite en el Waldorf. Y más autos que amigos. Tengo ganas de no tener ganas. Tengo un par de mascotas que no saben quién soy. Y entre tanto que tengo, no encuentro razón suficiente para olvidarme de ti. Y de tu mano pequeña diciéndome adiós. Esa tarde de lluvia en San Juan. De los besos que llevo conmigo, que son solo tuyos y nunca te di. Por andar ocupado en el cielo, me olvidé que en el suelo se vive mejor. Mi boricua, mi india, mi amor, mi asignatura pendiente. Mi boricua, mi india, mi amor, asignatura pendiente. Tengo tres oficinas y un piso en New York. Tengo tanto que no tengo nada. Tengo varias razones para tener razón, de que no hay peor razón que el olvido. Tengo intacto al niño que fui. Tengo ganas de anclar otras tantas de huir a un sitio perdido. Tengo ganas de no tener ganas, de comprarme un boleto de regreso al ayer. Si entre tanto que tengo no encuentro razón suficiente para olvidarme de ti. Y de tu mano pequeña diciéndome adiós, esa tarde de lluvia en San Juan. De los besos que llevo conmigo, que son solo tuyos y nunca te di. Por andar ocupado en el cielo, me olvidé que en el suelo se vive mejor. Mi boricua, mi india, mi amor, mi asignatura pendiente. Mi boricua, mi india, mi amor. Mi asignatura pendiente.
Sí, tal vez pudieras comprender que no sé cómo expresarme bien. Sí, tal vez pudiera hacerte ver que no hay otra mujer mejor que tú para mí.
Sí, tal vez me harías muy feliz. Sí, tal vez me lo podrías decir. Sí, tal vez detalle a detalle podrías conquistarme, sería tuya.
Te quiero tanto, 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 tanto.
Con nuestro amor, lo bello que es amar.
Y tal vez lo vuelva a repetir, pareja por pareja, el mundo entero al fin.
Te quiero tanto, 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 cada día un poco más.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with award-winning journalist Aaron Mate on the situation between Israel and Gaza.
We'll hear profound insights and possible solutions to the intractable and horrible situation in Gaza. And we'll also speak with media analyst and author Norman Solomon about his recent article, Unilateral Sanity Could Save the World.
We're talking about the United States building a new generation of nuclear weapons and the threat it poses to all of us.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
What kind of nation cuts off food, water, medicine, electricity, and fuel to 2 1/3 million Palestinians and then bombs them as they sit trapped in the open-air prison, which is the Gaza Strip? What kind of national leader in his capacity as the Israeli Minister of Defense says, quote, "We are fighting human animals and we are acting accordingly," close quote. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu promised that, quote, "We will turn Gaza into a deserted island," close quote. What kind of a nation vetoes a ceasefire as the U.S. did in a 13-1 vote when it was proposed at the United Nations Security Council? The Israeli and American nation find themselves morally isolated on the world stage. The American government supplies the weapons of war to a nation that has so far annihilated at least 20,000 people, including 8,000 children. The Israelis use weapons made in the U.S. and paid for by our tax dollars. American foreign policy is driven by the military-industrial complex. It's a country whose weapons industry is closely allied with the weapons industry of Israel, and a country whose government is heavily influenced by the Israeli lobby, a lobby that should be forced to register as an agent of a foreign country. We speak today with Aaron Mate about the continuing genocide in Gaza, which is now approaching 100 days. He's a journalist with The Gray Zone, where he hosts Pushback. He's also the co-host of Useful Idiots. In 2019, Aaron Mate won the Izzy Award for Outstanding Achievement in Independent Media for the Russiagate coverage that he wrote in The Nation magazine. Aaron Mate, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Good to be here.
Aaron, how do you appreciate the extensiveness of the slaughter of the Palestinians and the depth of cruelty that the Israelis have shown? Is this an aspect of what colonial settler states do to the native populations, or is there an element of revenge here for the October 7 attack?
You know, it's hard to put into words. It's just pure barbarism, pure sadism. And I do think this is how settler colonial states act. And Israel is unique in that its settler colonial project is ongoing. You know, here in the U.S., this country was founded by exterminating basically the bulk of the indigenous population. In the case of Israel-Palestine, that process is still ongoing. And we're seeing from Israeli officials the open desire to continue it, to ethnically cleanse Gaza. And in terms of revenge for October 7th, yeah, I do think that there's an element of revenge, but I don't think it's to avenge any deaths on October 7th. Because, you know, if Israel really cared about their own people right now in Gaza, they wouldn't be bombing Gaza to smithereens. They'd be negotiating to get the release of the remaining hostages. I think this is revenge because, you know, when you're an occupying power and you get humiliated by the natives, by the people you're occupying, I think that's what is driving the thirst for revenge here. That, you know, Israel felt it could imprison this caged population after displacing them. And on October 7th, Hamas fought back and managed to humiliate the occupier and inflict a defeat. So when we're talking now about revenge, I think this is the revenge of a colonial power trying to remind everybody, especially the people of Gaza, you know, who really is in charge. And they're carrying it out in the most sadistic way possible.
Aaron Mate, the Israeli government admitted they had the Hamas attack plan in advance of October 7th. They knew about it. The other day, the New York Times published aerial photographs Israelis took of the base in the north of Gaza from where part of the attack was launched. In fact, the Israelis had known about that base for quite a while, and they had even bombed it. The Israelis admitted that they had three battalions guarding the northern border of Gaza, and they pulled two of them out and sent them to the West Bank. Do you conclude from this that the Israelis knew about the attack beforehand and used it as a pretext to destroy the people of Gaza and their society, drive them out and take the land? Or did they just take advantage of the October 7th Hamas attack?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure if I buy into the theory that Israel let this happen just so it could have a pretext to destroy Gaza. I wouldn't rule it out. But I'm inclined to believe, you know, and this is all speculation, so I don't have any inside knowledge here, but that this was just the hubris of an occupier, that Israel was so drunk on its own power and so determined to keep colonizing the West Bank that they took their eye off of Gaza. They thought they had the people there successfully caged and pacified and defeated. And it was that kind of hubris that let this happen. I know there's plenty of stories now about the government being warned, and I don't dismiss those. But I also wonder to what extent that is driven by people inside the Israeli national security state who just want to get Netanyahu out, who share his political views and share his determination to ethnically cleanse Palestine, but just want somebody else to do it. So I don't rule out the possibility that Netanyahu and other top people let this happen, but I also think there are other explanations which just have to do with what happens when you're a colonial power. You take your eye off the ball and you get lazy. But, you know, in terms of what they're doing now, there's just no doubt that this has nothing to do with restoring Israeli security, nothing to do with Israel defending itself. As a former Israeli prime minister, Naftali Bennett, said, this is about, we have to make our enemies fear us. And this is what Israelis have said forever. We have to make them fear us. Ariel Sharon in 1967 said that our main deterrence is our enemy's fear of us. So that's what all these Israeli actions are about. It's about ethnically cleansing, continuing the mission that began in around 1948, a little bit before, to ethnically cleanse Palestine, and restoring fear in the hearts of anybody who dares resist, who dares try to stand up for their rights.
The great historian Isaac Deutscher commented that if a person was in a building that caught on fire and had to jump out the window, and that person landed on someone, at least that person should say, "I'm sorry." But the leaders of the worldwide Zionist effort have never done so. Was it always their intent to displace the native Palestinians?
Yeah, it was. If you go back and read early Zionist history, you have leaders like Zev Jabotinsky, who wrote that Zionism is a colonizing adventure, and therefore it stands on the question of armed force. He was at the right-wing end of the Zionist spectrum, but then you have, you know, David Ben-Gurion, who's the founding prime minister of Israel, very major Zionist leader. He also called for expelling Palestinians, even as he publicly accepted the UN partition plan. So, yeah, this is just embedded into Zionism pretty much from the start. And now, you know, you had elements of Zionism that did not endorse this. Ahad Hayam was an early Zionist leader who talked about not having a Jewish state that would privilege Jewish people, but having a Jewish national home. And when I was growing up and learning about Zionism, you know, I was very sympathetic to that. And I still am, you know, in theory. But the reality is the political movement of Zionism and the main factions of it always saw Zionism as an effort to establish a Jewish state in which Jews' rights would be privileged. And that required for them, as they recognized openly, to expel the indigenous Palestinian population.
The leaders of the Zionist movement in the early days, about a century ago, tried to get support from the Russian Tsar, the German Kaiser, and the Ottoman Empire, but were turned down. They eventually got support from the British, and then, of course, the Americans. Was this support from a great power crucial to the establishment of Israel and the maintenance of the Zionist government?
Yeah, of course. I mean, Israel owes its existence to colonial powers, namely Britain. Britain ruled over Mandate-era Palestine, and Lord Balfour wrote that famous memo basically saying that we're going to establish a Jewish homeland. And he talked vaguely about the indigenous people, the indigenous Arabs who are already there. And he talked something about, you know, like, while not infringing on their rights, but he said nothing about the fact that this was their land and that they were being displaced. And so it was that British collaboration with the Zionist movement that allowed for Israel to be created in the first place. Now, it should be said, when Israel was founded in 1948 with the UN partition plan, that had the support of the Soviet Union and the U.S. And so they have a responsibility too. But it was Britain that initially decided, because it was the colonial power, that it could promise a land that wasn't theirs to another people's whose land it wasn't either. And that's where this begins. And of course, as Britain then declined in power after the Second World War, the U.S. filled that role after 67. Between 48 and 67, the U.S. was kind of indifferent toward Israel, wasn't against it, but wasn't actively protecting it the way it is now. But in 67, Israel showed that it could smash Arab nationalism when it launched the 1967 war in June 1967. And after that, Israel became a client state of the U.S.
What is fascism? Smotrich, a minister in Netanyahu's government, calls himself a, quote, a proud fascist. Is it accurate to characterize the Israeli government as fascist, or fascist at least with respect to the treatment of Palestinians?
Absolutely. But, you know, I would extend that characterization beyond just the current, you know, far-right government of Netanyahu and all these other characters to the entire occupation since 67. There's a quote from a Israeli general who was said to be sort of at the liberal end of the spectrum. And in 1967, after Israel took it over, and he basically said that the under Israeli occupation, this is what life will be like for Palestinians. He said, you Palestinians as a nation don't want us today, but we'll change your attitude by forcing our presence on you. And then he went on to say, you will, quote, live like dogs, and whoever will leave will leave. And that general was Moshe Dayan, who was, you know, a very famous Israeli general, and he was considered to be somewhat sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. So that's at the liberal end of the spectrum, saying that these people under our rule will live like dogs. And that's, you know, to me what fascism is. It, the people of Palestine didn't vote for the Israeli occupiers to come rule over them and take their land. And that has been, across the Israeli spectrum, the dominant attitude since really the founding of the state.
As the Nazi regime in Germany was exterminating the Jews, they kept quiet. They used misinformation and deception. To what extent do you think that the Israeli population is knowledgeable about what's being done now?
Well, you know, I haven't been to Israel in over 20 years. So I, you know, it's hard for me to speak with some authority on that because I haven't been there. But if you listen to Gideon Levy, the columnist for Haaretz, who's been one of the few principled voices in Israeli public life for a long time now, speaking out against the occupation, he says that Israelis are not shown images of Gaza on television. And the media has become so jingoistic, so militarist, that they just openly cheer the Israeli army and they don't show their audiences the realities of what's going on. But, you know, it also must be said that Israeli society as a whole has really moved to the right in the last two decades. After the Second Intifada broke out, or since then, the Israeli peace movement, what it used to be called, has pretty much disappeared. And, you know, there are different reasons for that. The standard narrative is that the suicide bombing that Hamas oversaw in the, you know, early 2000s, that really made a big difference. But also, it must be said that the what's called the peace movement inside Israel was still fundamentally wedded to this idea of a Jewish supremacist state, of a state that privileged Jews over everybody else. And when you have that, you're not going to be able to recognize the humanity of the other side, even if you think you want peace and you want to live with coexistence. And so, you know, based on this colonial presence, I guess it was sort of inevitable that Israel was always going to go in this direction, because if you're founded on ethnic cleansing, if you're founded on the idea that one ethnicity is superior to the other and has more rights, then inevitably, especially when people fight back, you're going to, rather than try to undo your own settler mindset, you're just going to dehumanize the people who are fighting back. And that's pretty much what Israel has seen. And that's why now you don't really have really any peace movement left at all in Israel. If you look at the protests against the ongoing genocide, they're very, very small. It's a very small number of people.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with Attorney Maria Hall. You're listening to Law and Disorder, and we're interviewing the journalist Aaron Mate. Aaron, since October 7, a number of villages on the West Bank have been ethnically cleansed of their native Palestinian population. Several hundred Palestinians have been killed so far. The West Bank is the size of the state of Delaware. 700,000 Israelis have settled there. It's a territory Israelis took by force in the 1967 war that you mentioned, contrary to international law. Doesn't this negate any possibility of a two-state solution?
Well, certainly Israel wants to negate any possibility of a two-state solution. And, you know, it's worth pointing out these pogroms going on in the West Bank have been happening well before October 7th. There were villages that were ethnically cleansed upon Israel's founding, obviously, but even in recent years too, it's still been going on. There is a West Bank village named Kirbet Zanuta. There are others that have been facing this. David Shulman, who is an Israeli, has written about this in the New York Review of Books. Plenty of others have. So this has been happening for a while. You know, in terms of the possibilities of a two-state solution, I mean, obviously for me, my ideal scenario would be a a state premised on equality for everybody. In the short term, however, you know, I don't know if it's worth thinking that the two-state solution is impossible, because, look, what makes a two-state solution impossible are these illegal Israeli settlement blocks that Israel has built up since 67. But why should we grant them any legitimacy? Those settlement blocks should be dismantled, and every settler there should leave. That's international law. You know, international law, you can't build up your own population in territory you've conquered by force, which is what the West Bank is. Now, the world, most of it, recognizes Israel within its 1948 borders, its pre-June 67 borders. So I don't think it's unreasonable to insist that Israel should dismantle all of its settlements and have all those settlers leave. If Israel were to do that, then I think you could have a Palestinian state. And for me personally, in terms of, you know, how to get out of this current monstrosity, I do think a reasonable solution would be to insist, first of all, as an interim settlement, the establishment of a Palestinian state, just to have some kind of separation between Palestinians and their occupiers, and then eventually move towards a one-state solution. That, you know, that to me is the ideal, but it's so far off that I think in the short term, it'd be worth calling for something that is possibly realizable. And to me, given that, you know, international law says you cannot have these settlements there, I think it's a short-term solution would be to call for dismantling all these settlements and have everybody pack up and leave, go back to Brooklyn or move to Israel, rather than stealing Palestinian land. But yes, the point of the settlement is to make this two-state solution impossible. That's the point of everything that Israel does. I just don't think we, as people who are not the Israeli government and its supporters, I don't see why we have to accept the solution that they're trying to impose.
Polls have shown that the Israeli war against Palestinians in Gaza is popular with the Israeli population. How do you explain this?
Israel's turned into a fanatical state. It's just gone crazy, I think. I don't know how else to explain it. And it's what happens when you're a settler colonial state and you make no effort to try to reckon with your past. It's completely drunk on power. It's completely consumed with this idea of being superior than the land's indigenous people. And I don't know what can be done about that. You know, you have some Israeli politicians who are still trying to stand up for what's right, but there's only a small number of them, and they even face persecution at home. They face, you know, people get suspended from the Knesset. People face violent threats. So it's a state that's just completely blind to the oppression, the suffering, the genocide that it's inflicting on Palestinians. And it's given impunity by the world's most powerful country, the U.S. The both parties, Democrats and Republicans, are in lockstep behind Israel. Similarly here, if anybody dissents, they get smeared, they get censured, like Rashida Tlaib was censured by Republicans in Congress for daring to call for her people's freedom. And so when you have a country that's consumed with bigotry and supremacy, that has a green light and all the support from the world's most powerful state, you just have carte blanche for genocide, which is what we're seeing right now.
Aaron Maté, unfortunately, we're coming down to the end of our allotted time, but I have one last question I want to ask you before Maria is going to ask you how can people follow your work. But what I was wondering, as a socialist, historically, socialists have opposed the Zionist project as an exclusively Jewish state. They have called for an Israel state that represents all of its citizens. They're against a Christian state or a Muslim state on principle. They're for a separation of church and state. What's your position, and how do you see this ending?
Well, ideally, I would like to see a state where everybody is equal, and that would also reckon with the historic injustice upon which it was founded. So you know, recognizing the right of return for all Palestinians and compensating them for all the suffering that has been inflicted on them, all the damage, all the homes that were stolen, all the olive groves that were uprooted, all the lives that were destroyed by Israel. There needs to be a reckoning with that. And ideally, this would come as part of a process of making the state an actual democracy where everybody's equal and Jews are not privileged. That to me is ideal, but I think it's so far away that I think we have to think about some more immediate steps that can happen sooner rather than down the line. And I do think it's fair to advocate, at least for now, for the establishment of an actual Palestinian state, not one in the Israeli vision, which is just, you know, a series of disconnected Bantustans surrounded by Israeli settlements, but an actual Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, which Palestinians have already accepted, their leadership has at least, with no Israeli settlements. All the Israeli settlers, if they want to stay and be citizens of this Palestinian state, you know, Palestinians can decide whether they want that or not. But if Palestinians don't want that, then these settlers should pack up and go home. Go back to Brooklyn and Canada and South Africa, or move to Israel proper. But there's no reason at all for these settlements to exist inside the West Bank. And given that Israel had, you know, Israel's 1948 borders are recognized, it's a lot harder to advocate for full equality now. But given that nobody recognizes the legality of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, that's something I think that could be achieved a lot easier in the short term. And then from there, we can move on to equality. I mean, you know, I understand for a Palestinian that that's a hard outcome to accept, because why should you accept for a second this state in any boundaries that's founded on your dispossession? So I understand that position. I'm just trying to think of what could be a more achievable short-term goal that could at least get us out of the current situation that we're in. And then after that, I would say we move on to pressing for full equality in all of Palestine.
Well, Aaron Mate, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us. Please tell us before you go, how can people follow your work?
You can go to thegrayzone.com, where I work as a journalist, and I also co-host a podcast with Katie Halper called Useful Idiots. That's usefulidiotspodcast.com. And my Substack newsletter is my name, aaronmate.net. And thanks for having me.
Aaron Mate, thank you for being on Law and Disorder. Very, very enlightening. And we certainly appreciate your good work. Very good new year to you and your family. You take it easy.
Thanks, Michael and Maria. Appreciate it. You too.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
How does it feel when it's quiet and calm? And will I be denied? How will it feel when it's time to move on? Mother says kneel and pray. When it gets hard, I will roam those leaves. Life can be so unkind. I will be found on the edge of the world, where there'll be no one around. Oh, solid ground.
As we begin 2024, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists just reset its nuclear doomsday clock for the 24th time in its 76-year history. They created the doomsday clock just after World War II to visually represent the threat of global nuclear annihilation. Although the precise time won't be announced until later this month, the most recent change was just 1 year ago, in January 2023, when the clock was moved forward to 90 seconds till midnight, the closest to midnight ever. What will 2024 bring?
Will we get swept up in the momentum and fervor towards global catastrophe? Or can we muster the will and courage to act, to try to save one another, animals, the earth, and ourselves? In his article, Unilateral Sanity Could Save the World, our guest, author, and political analyst, Norman Solomon, invokes Antonio Gramsci's philosophy of keeping a, quote, pessimism of the intellect, but an optimism of the will. Norman Solomon is a longtime associate of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the national director of RootsAction.org, and the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. His books include War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, and his latest book, War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine, was just published by the New Press in June of 2023. Norman Solomon, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Very glad to be here.
Great. Well, to start us off, in your article, you use the term omnicide. I've never read or heard that term in the media before. What does omnicide mean? And why do you think it's not used more often in the press?
It's really unfamiliar to us because it's almost never even mentioned in media in the United States. And it basically means that almost all human life on the planet would be exterminated from a nuclear war. Obviously, very unpleasant, unfathomable, and so we don't hear about that very real possibility from nuclear war, whether it's through the news media or politicians.
Norman Solomon, in your article, you write about the late Daniel Ellsberg, very courageous man. He's most famous for his role in exposing the government's lies about the Vietnam War in the Pentagon Papers in 1971. But his activism spanned many decades. Could you please talk about Dan's criticism of nuclear weapons, and what advice might he have for us going into 2024?
Dan Ellsberg actually was focused on the dangers of nuclear war throughout his adult life. And as you mentioned, he's known as the Vietnam War upper echelon planner who eventually divulged the Pentagon Papers in 1971. But his focus on nuclear weapons began much earlier than that in the Kennedy administration. And after he was acquitted from the charges of public service, really, divulging the Pentagon Papers, he spent the next 52 years of his life largely focusing not only on these aggressive wars that the United States has continually been involved in, but especially the threat of nuclear war. And to focus on that was often to exclude him from mainstream media. I know that working with him, it was at times very difficult to get him onto TV or radio. And yet Dan Ellsberg was, as his book The Doomsday Machine spells out in detail, very immersed as a nuclear war planner, and he brought to the world in that book, in his activism for five decades, a very clear analysis of why we are in danger of nuclear war and why it is so crucial that we wake up from the sleepwalking and confront this, what Dr. King called the madness of militarism that reaches its real ultimate extent with the very real danger of nuclear war.
In your article, you suggest we may, in fact, be closer to a nuclear catastrophe than at any time since the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1961. Back then, the Kennedy administration was able to narrowly avert a lose-lose battle with the Soviet Union. What lessons can and should President Biden learn from that time, particularly in relation to dealing with Russia?
Well, the phrase you used, lose-lose, is actually quite appropriate because this is not a zero-sum game with nuclear weapons. We all win or we all lose. We win if sanity prevails. We lose if the momentum of the nuclear arms race continues to the precipice and over it that is right in front of us. One of the lessons from the Cuban Missile Crisis that was absolutely crucial was articulated by President Kennedy in his commencement speech at American University in 1962, after the Cuban Missile Crisis. And he said it's absolutely crucial that one nuclear power does not push the leader of another nuclear power into a corner to try to get humiliation and defeat to the point that that leader feels there's no viable option other than to use nuclear weapons. And as I've been pointing out in recent months, during the Ukraine war, the reality is that the Biden administration has pursued exactly the opposite policy. I say that the wisdom of John F. Kennedy's speech at American University is now in the White House dumpster, and we have an administration and a bipartisan near consensus on Capitol Hill that's in this sort of macho Cold War mentality. Let's enrich the arms makers more and more, although they don't say that. Let's sink multi-billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars into building a new generation of ICBMs, land-based nuclear missiles, that we shouldn't have at all because they increase the chances of nuclear war by being on hair trigger alert. The mentality that's prevailing is absolutely a 180 from the lessons that President Kennedy drew from the nearly catastrophic Cuban Missile Crisis.
Norman, something that President Kennedy never had to face is the proliferation of intercontinental ballistic missiles, ICBMs. Former Defense Secretary William Perry called ICBMs the most dangerous weapons in the world. Do you agree? And if so, what makes them so deadly?
Well, I do agree, and it's a reality that is very difficult to convey through the U.S. news media and even progressive media, often because of a focus on other topics, really rarely goes into the reality that these nuclear weapons in particular, the land-based part of the so-called triad, in contrast to the air-launched and the sea-based nuclear weapons, are by their very nature hair trigger. They're on launch on warning alert because unlike the sea and land-based nuclear weapons, these particular weapons, the ICBMs, are in a mode of use them or lose them. The reason is they're vulnerable. Nuclear weapons on submarines, they're not vulnerable to being wiped out in an attack. Likewise, the airborne nuclear weapons. But the mentality that these land-based ICBMs create and sustain is, well, we might be under attack, and if we are, we better launch our weapons first. And so it's probably not that the U.S. would be under attack. It's that maybe it's a flock of geese being misunderstood on the radar, which has happened in the past. We've been very fortunate in the nuclear age to still be here, to be able to discuss this at this moment, for listeners to be alive to hear it. What Daniel Ellsberg continued to do throughout his adult life is to try to wake us up to realize that this arms race is insanity. It's the ultimate of the insanity that Martin Luther King Jr. warned about, not only when he denounced what he called the madness of militarism, but when he accepted the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964. He said, "I refuse to accept the idea that we must spiral down as humanity into thermonuclear hell." And this is the blockage of mentality, of denial, that is prevailing in the mass media, on Capitol Hill, and in the White House. And as always, with crucial issues, progressives and others, however we define ourselves, need to recognize that the imperative changes will not come from the top. They're certainly not going to come from Wall Street or corporate America. They're not going to come from Pennsylvania Avenue. They're going to come from us as we learn, as we educate ourselves and others, as we organize and as we agitate and as we fight for political power, because that's the only way that nuclear war really can be averted.
And speaking of that top-down message, rather than backing away from reliance on ICBMs and other nukes, the U.S. has announced a nuclear modernization plan. Can you explain what's entailed in that plan? And speaking of Wall Street, what's the price tag?
It is an ultimate derangement, the top-down insanity that normalizes what is a push over towards the precipice of nuclear conflagration. The euphemisms really prevail. So you cited one, modernization. Well, that means that some corporations will get very rich fine-tuning the preparations for Armageddon. You have Northrop Grumman, one of the main Pentagon contractors. They've already got $13 billion with a B dollars just to do some planning for this new version of the Minuteman III, the ICBMs that are in five different states in underground silos. I mean, talk about hidden in plain sight. These are annihilation instruments that are in the ground in the United States. Everybody knows where they are. And those 400 weapons are poised on hair trigger alert to do something very insanely stupid, which is to increase the chances of nuclear war by being there in the first place. And there's this whole bugaboo and taboo politically and in U.S. mass media against what's called unilateral disarmament. You know, we can't do that. We're not going to be wimps. We're going to be having so-called peace through strength. And it's counterintuitive but very real that in the case of these land-based ICBMs, the only way to make us safer in connection with those weapons is to shut them down, not just some of them, but all of them, and yes, to do it unilaterally if necessary. The Russians have an equivalent number. The Chinese are building them, and people are told by corporate America, by news media, oh, well, you can't unilaterally shut yours down because the other side has them. Well, I use the analogy, let's say we're standing in a deep pool of gasoline, and those we think who are our adversaries are lighting matches, and we're lighting matches. Well, it would be a sane thing to do to stop lighting matches. And yet, if we were to do that, we would be accused of unilateral disarmament, doing it on our own. Well, sometimes sanity needs to prevail, and we have to start.
Norman, during the Cold War, and especially in the 70s and 80s, there were massive protests. I was on several of them, where hundreds of thousands of people marched against nuclear proliferation. Why aren't we seeing that kind of organizing and awareness now? And this danger is so great. I mean, who's doing anything? And why aren't we seeing anything?
Well, the stakes are, as you say, so huge. And it's a paradox because the larger the stakes, the more they seem to be hidden in plain sight. I mean, there was a lot of attention to the film Oppenheimer that premiered last summer, and it was a brief reawakening. But overall, as you say, there has been a real quiescence in the last decade. Part of it was the end of the Cold War at the end of the 1980s. People were lulled into a false sense of security, even while these nuclear weapons have become more accurate, which makes the military mentality more willing and able to contemplate and plan for nuclear war. We have been, by omission quite often, conditioned to separate overall militarism and wars from the part of the warfare state apparatus that involves nuclear weapons, which are, of course, the ultimate war, the ultimate destruction and the madness that militarism leads us to. And so we've been really encouraged to separate from U.S. aggressiveness in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Libya, in Syria, and elsewhere, from the underpinning of the entire military doctrine of the United States. And I think it's really notable that although Russia has been appropriately condemned for its public statements through Vladimir Putin and others that it would consider in certain circumstances using nuclear weapons in Ukraine, the fact is that the United States government has always had identical doctrine, which is if our backs are up against the wall, we affirm that we reserve the right to be the first to use nuclear weapons in a conflict, which is a way of saying our government takes a position, it has the right to start nuclear war. You can't think of a more insane policy in terms of humanity, and yet there it is.
Well, Norman Solomon, the presidential election in November will probably come down to a contest between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. I may be wrong, but that's what we're looking at right now. For First Amendment advocates like yourself, I'm guessing that prospect is less than inspiring. So tell us, are you ever tempted just to hide under the covers and knock it out of bed? From where do you find your inspiration to keep pushing forward?
It's tempting to, metaphorically or not, pull the covers over our heads. And yet, we never get anywhere by passivity. We know everything we have to be proud of in the United States is not because it was handed down from on high by media or political titans. It's because people organized from the bottom up. And you know, like many other activists, I'm inspired by the history, past and present, of people who are willing to organize, who will go against the grain to create the civil rights movement or build it, the women's rights movement, gay rights, to fight for the human rights for health care, education, and housing, to oppose the U.S. invasion and slaughter of people in Iraq, now to oppose the Israeli slaughter of people in Gaza. We have people who are doing nonviolent civil disobedience around the United States to oppose the U.S. support for the killing of so many civilians in Gaza by the Israeli government, while the U.S. government provides billions of dollars more of weaponry. That's inspiring because people are not only understanding what's at stake, but doing something about it and working together. These changes will not happen vertically. They'll happen horizontally because we work with each other and we insist that human life is worth fighting for.
This is Michael Smith. I'm with Maria Hall. You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio, and we have as our guest Norman Solomon talking about the nuclear catastrophe that may be upon us. Norman, would you please talk about some of the organizations that are trying to do something about this threat?
Well, I'm very biased. I work at rootsaction.org, and we now have more than 1 million people who are online supporters who have signed up, who get our alerts, and it's about action. And we're in a coalition with a couple of hundred other organizations. It's called Defuse Nuclear War, and people can find information there and sign up for action alerts just by going to defusenuclearwar.org. There are many other groups that are very active, and they are willing and able to challenge the warfare state. I think that the nuclear weapons context, as I have mentioned, is woefully under-discussed and under-addressed. And so I encourage people to look for your local chapters, for instance, of Peace Action. It's a national group with many chapters around the country. Peace Action does wonderful work, and it's a recognition that as individuals, we will not get very far. It's always about organizing.
Norman, I wanted to ask you about the Cuban Missile Crisis. I lived through it. It was plenty scary. And fortunately, we had a smart, reasonable person like John Kennedy as our president. That may not be the case next time. Could you talk about how scary it was, the nuclear threat that happened to the Cuban Missile Crisis, how we got out of it,